Lecture 5, Translatio Studii and Westward Expansionism.
The Translatio Studii and its late 19th and 20th century variants, I will call them extensions rather than variants, offers a solution to the problem Professor Pease posed both for Edward Taylor and for Nathaniel Hawthorne, that movement on the part of Taylor from the Great Awakening as site formerly occupied by the Great Migration, or the Great Awakening as being substitute for the Great Migration, moving from, if you will, a spatial promised specialized space to an internal space. Hawthorne presented, as he gave him to us, another case. That is, Hawthorne's desire to use the Puritan past to recover what he saw as a lost vitality in his own day, what he saw as threats to the established ethos of his own day, those contradictions posed by the slave narratives, those contradictions posed by a range of movements, the women's movement among them. And it seems to me that that move, that attempt to use the past as the basis on which to construct a future, runs through our literature like a vein of ore. And in one sense, to come back to the Translatio Studii as it develops in 18th and 19th century, I want to leap to the 20th century to enact in the lecture, if you will, the same movement to move into the past to get ahead. Or as one writer will say it, borrowing and paraphrasing Dante, the end is in the beginning and lies far ahead. And the place I want to pause in the 20th century, rather, is in the 30s, at Hart Crane's poem, The Bridge. Now, its thematic connections with Whitman are fairly obvious, since Whitman is named, and Whitman poems are named in the poem itself. But there are other connections I am more interested in here. The way in which the poem reacts to a 20th century malaise, does the myth of exceptionality still apply? Is the Translatio Studii still possible? And Crane's poem executes an act of recovery. Earliest central figure in the poem is Columbus. But we also meet Pocahontas in the poem, Edgar Allan Poe, Emily Dickinson, Herman Melville, and of course, Walt Whitman, who is the principal inspiring force for the poem. But if Whitman attempted in nature, in that great garden of the New World, first given to us in Smith's description, in a blade of grass or leaf of grass to understand all life, Crane is aware that for him in the 20th century, nature no longer presents that paysage moralisé, that landscape in which we can read great moral truths. His is an industrial age, and he chooses that late 19th century miracle of engineering and technology, the Brooklyn Bridge, and asks that bridge to lend a myth to God. He is seeking a myth. And in order to execute, in order to construct that myth in his own day, he needs to go back to those earlier writers, those earlier figures who knew how to make myth. Hence the fascination in the work with Whitman. In addition, Crane's work represents only one of a horde of epic poems attempted by American poets, one of which I will focus on today in my discussion. A second 20th century moment, how do we get back to it, is a question Willie Loman poses in Death of a Salesman. Somewhere back there, there was trust, there was faith, and things worked. Or, for that matter, Amanda Wingfield experienced that, turning now to Tennessee Williams' Glass Menagerie. She remembers that day she led the cotillion. She has that same dress, and in that one moment of high hope, she regarbs herself, attempting to reconstitute herself as the lovely belle she once was, not as the woman she is in the past. Nothing is worse in the Translatio than age. Or it is Gatsby refusing to accept a comment that you can't relive the past. Gatsby, in a novel described as a story of the West. That westward movement, which I have referred to as the Translatio Studei, we met earlier when we looked at Bishop Berkeley's poem on the planting of arts and sciences in the New World. As you will recall, he gives us a five-stage or five-act drama. The movement is from a decaying older civilization in an eastern site to a more vital new site west of that. And so the movement, Egypt to Greece to ancient Rome to Renaissance England, does rehearse that westward movement, which is the Translatio Studei. Progress in the arts and sciences moves in a westerly direction. Again, from a decaying eastern site to a vital new locus in the west. And if we represent the fifth act in that westward movement, that Translatio Studei, what happens when we arrive in this new place? What happens to our sense of progressive history, of millenarianism? What happens to our entire sense of soteriological history if we are the end of? And it is the Translatio and its variants that offer us something other than the end of the dream in this Western site. Most obvious, it offers a space so that embedded in our myth of the Translatio is not an ending with the arrival here, but it is a constant locus of a frontier west of where we are, a frontier where we can always begin again, where the Loman boys can raise cattle, where you can discover that gold. And it is that constant movement, that frontier which is always just ahead of us, that makes possible renewal in a spatial sense, which is different from the internal renewal we experience in Taylor's Meditations. We can note that also if we arrange Cooper's leather stocking tales in chronological order, not in the order in which they were published. And we realize that in that series of novels, we move with the frontier with his, quote, leather stocking, natty bumpo, et cetera, character, constantly moving. And the last work in that series is, of course, The Prairies. Again, that frontier which is always available, extending the Translatio Studii across the American continent. And that is exactly the move that is enacted in Hart Crane's poem, The Bridge, following that frontier all the way to the Pacific Ocean and executing a new turn. Given the centrality of the journey into nationhood constructed on biblical models and themes, if it is so that this is that greatest, that fifth act in the great epic of civilization, if we are in truth the product of the myth of American exceptionality, then we must have that mark, that cultural sign of nationhood, and that is the epic of our experience in history. And one of the early attempts at that is that work of Joel Barlow, his poem, The Columbiad. Enter Joel Barlow and his sponsor, Robert Fulton. And when we note Joel Barlow's Columbiad, a poem which not many people read anymore, perhaps it's too long for soundbite days, but we have to see the seeming arrogance of Barlow's introduction in the context of the mythic space that I've been calling the Translatio Studii. That is, if we are not willfully attempting to misunderstand Barlow. Central to his argument in the introduction is that the American epic will be superior to all of the earlier epics because it does represent a first. Again, we are obsessed with being the climax of civilization and also being its primary, its initiating move at one and the same time. In other words, we run through from childhood to old age without ever passing through adulthood. The epic will be great, Barlow argues, because no epic has been written under conditions that approach the ideal conditions under which he will work. That is, we have for the first time in history a great poet, and Homer was a great poet. Virgil was a great poet. Milton was a great poet. But look at the dreck they had to write about, says Barlow. They did not have this perfect society, war mad, dictatorial, non-democratic, etc., etc., etc. But now we have both poet and nation ideally situated, and out of it comes the Columbiad. So his will be the first epic of his kind. And the history in that 1800 epic begins, believe it or not, with Columbus. With Columbus' western voyage. And with Columbus' disillusionment with his mission, with his sense that he has failed, we're back again into that very sense of falling away from the ideal that has been so much the preoccupation of our writers as they try to recapture that ideal first state, that fresh sense of the nation, that virgin land, etc., etc. Columbus despondent. Hesper, the spirit of the new world, enters his cell and assures him that he has done a great work, that he doesn't know how great that work is. Hesper then shows him visions, beginning with his westward journey, of that march of progress, which marks the history of the U.S., and then goes on to prophesy a glorious future. And, of course, Columbus is rejuvenated by this vision. Hesper, the spirit of the West, is able to create for Columbus a rising glory poem. Is able, in a sense, to recreate the Columbian Exposition, one of those displays of the great achievements of the nation that were so popular with late 19th and early 20th century audiences. And it's not odd that in this poem, those great achievements are extended to include achievements in manufactures, achievements in technology. Remember, Fulton is one of the financial backers of the poem itself. And if we got that glorious garden replete with every possible food, we get now the cultural products of America, the technological products of America, the manufactures of America. We have gone, to use Thomas Cole's visual image, from the savage state to the pastoral state, that perfect balance between the civilized and the savage. But the poem is not without its negatives. There are things you can't blink in 1800, and one of them is slavery. And so if Hesper, the spirit of the West, arrives, Atlas, the spirit of Africa, also arrives and delivers a running, ringing indictment of America for enslaving his people. Interestingly enough, if we look at the positioning of this condemnation, this negative moment, we find it is quite neatly placed so that it does not interfere with the great future prophecy, which will not include slavery, but includes no mention of what happened to those people unless they got suddenly infertile and all disappeared, which is implied even in our very name, mulatto, those of more than one racial strain, mulatto, little mule, sterile, they will not reproduce themselves, we hope, because they give the lie to an important myth, the very name and erasure. So the castigation by Atlas, reduced, I would argue, by positionality, by placement, does nothing to darken the glorious closing of the work. Now, I stated that Hesper enacts a rising glory poem for Columbus. And there we look at another one of the genres developed in 18th century, the rising glory poem. This genre first introduced in its clearest form, Hugh Henry Brackenridge and Philip Freneau collaborate on writing The Rising Glory of America. And in so doing, they create a genre. At most colonial commencements, such a poem would be composed and recited. And of course, it is central that that poem close on this glorious vision of the future. And what is interesting for me is the way in which, as we reach another low point, if you will, think, if you will, of the mood of the nation when a Kennedy comes into the presidency and we suddenly have, for the first time, a Rising Glory poem read at the inaugural. The author is Robert Frost, which he later published as A Gift Outright of the Gift Outright. He closed the poem with the poem, The Gift Outright. But he composed a long preface to that poem, a Horatian ode, as any good Rising Glory poem should be, which is a recital of our history, which climaxes in that glorious vision of the future. We get that genre coming back to us again at the Clinton inaugural. Maya Angelou composes a Rising Glory poem on the pulse of morning. And so that 18th century genre has come back. I would suggest it comes back at those times when we need reassurance in possibility. But in its purity, in the Breckenridge and Freneau, The Rising Glory of America, embedded in Joel Barlow's The Columbiad. Let me turn now to the relationship of another figure with this Westering myth, this Translatio Studei. And this figure is Phyllis Wheatley. But her relationship to the myth is complicated. In one respect, she reinscribes the myth. She reinforms, participates in the myth. And since her considerations are never anything but religious, she seems not to have read her journey westward from Africa to the United States as hell, as negative, as have many of her former African contemporaries. The movement was, for her, can be read as positive because it brings her to the knowledge of Christianity. It brings her to salvation. And that which is secular is beside the point for Wheatley. So it is an act of divine mercy that saves her from what she refers to as her pagan land. Yet in some of her poems to the students of Cambridge, for example, and her epistolary poem to George Washington, she does focus, however briefly, on the tragedy of being snatched from her land, from her parents. But these are exceptions to her usual relationship to the myth. The most important poem to consider when thinking about Wheatley and her place in American literatures is the poem that unfortunately almost never gets anthologized. And it is the poem To Maecenas. This is her signature poem. This is the poem with which she opens the book, defining herself through this poem. And to know Wheatley, you must know To Maecenas. It's an interesting turn she executes in that play. What does she do? The poem opens praising the brilliance of Homer, of Virgil, these great, great writers. And the poem is addressed to Maecenas. Now, those of us who are typology junkies have little trouble with that. Just as Maecenas was patron to the poet Terence or Terentius Afer, so John Wheatley is patron to Phyllis, he becomes typologically Maecenas, as she becomes typologically Terence. But why Terence? The poem begins, as I stated, clearly reinscribing the genius of Homer, Virgil. But then the poem says, but this is strange. If you are that great, why have the muses, why has history stated that Terence is your superior? And there we discover the only footnote in her entire book of poems. That footnote reads roughly that Terence was an African by birth. So here is the young Phyllis Wheatley in Boston, a slave to the Wheatley family, writing about Terence, an African by birth, slave to Maecenas, who is freed because of his brilliance as poet. You see already what she's executing, how that typological mind works. And it is that Phyllis agrees. Terence, or Terentius Afer, Terence the African, becomes the great poet, greater than the others. And she, as African poet, becoming African American poet, must clear a historical line that leads to her, must create a space in literary history that she can occupy, in spite of what Thomas Jefferson has said about the impossibility of any art coming from such a person. She legitimizes herself by rearranging literary history, by making that possible ancestor the great poet. And after reading that poem, you would not then make the mistake that many readers of Wheatley make when they talk about her as this meek, gentle, humble, whatever. That's a pretty radical and daring act to commit on your first page. But like the other poets of her age and the Augustine poets she admires, she writes within a limited range. There are limited genres. There are clearly limited stanza, line, rhyme arrangements. Augustan poetry does not valorize what we would call originality. It valorizes nature, general human experience. It valorizes your skill in handling the forms that have been passed down to us, not the sloppiness of trying to create a new form of your own. And so if her poems for us seem overly formal and hardly daring, she is a woman of her age. And that criticism we can make of the poets she admires and those who are her contemporaries. So the poems then come down to that epistolary poem, the elegy, which she is especially brilliant at, but another genre which is important for her, and she certainly writes the Rise in Glory poem, and that is the occasional poem. Again, the arrogance of this young black woman assuming such a position. For the occasional poem is that poem written about major events in the life of the culture, major figures in that culture. So that we'll find poems on the death of the Reverend Whitfield, one of the great figures in the First Great Awakening. We'll find poems on the victory. We find poems on the coming of a new ambassador to the provinces of Canada. And this is the function of the poet as representative person. Hardly the image of a meek, shy, little chickadee lady, which she was not. One final genre in which she excels again continues for us, and that is a kind of poem called the glorious contrast poem. It's implicated then in that westering myth, the Translatio Studii. We must then write poems which show how fresh and new and gorgeous is the American experience as opposed to the jaded absence of vitality which we find in the older sites of Europe. So the farewell to America is that kind of poem. We call it the glorious contrast poem. Think how differently a Henry James will deal with those thematics in his novels. Interestingly enough, Wheatley is almost unique in her use of the glorious contrast poems if we consider African-American writers and poets. Most of those black writers who follow her write ironically how wonderful England is as opposed to the United States. Again, she is almost unique in some questions of history and location, too detailed for me to get into at the moment. But that later treatment will be more the rule than her investing her energies and beliefs in the glorious contrast poems. But there's a more important challenge to the westering myth, the Translatio Studii, than the absence of glorious contrast poems. And that is the challenge to the very east-west orientation of that myth of history. That east-west orientation is extremely rare in literature written by African Americans. If we want to look at one difference in the two bodies of literature, it is the dominance in African American literature of a south to north orientation, I hope for obvious historical reasons. The westward movement could hardly be experienced as progress. But you can say something about the south to north movement. Now that looks like progress to me. And we find that even if we look at the short story, if we look at in our own century, James Baldwin's Sonny's Blues, it's set in New York City. But the movement is from Greenwich Village to Harlem. Greenwich Village to Harlem, north and south. If we look at Richard Wright's Native Son, it's set in Chicago, but the movement is from the south side to the north side, and somebody, I see heads nodding. Of course, I knew that all along. A very different relationship to space, because the promise is found in north, the site of progress, the site of prophetic fulfillment is found in that symbolic Canada. The goal of the early major documents, the fugitive slave narratives, is to reach that northern site. So a very basic difference here, clearly fixed in the different experience of the two groups. One final comment, and that is on Philip Freneau. I mentioned him early in relationship to Hugh Henry Brackenridge and the Rising Glory poem, and of course another Freneau poem that I think should be seen everywhere. It has a wonderful poem on the demolition of a small college, which is a hilarious poem about drunken students who absolutely destroy their college completely in a drunken riot. If you like drunken riots. Freneau, though, I would argue, is better known as the poet of the revolution. And that position achieved because Freneau must create, Freneau must construct that revolution as sacred calling, as a part of divine providence, so that it becomes not simply a war based on political or economic difference, but it is a war that, fitting in with Professor Pease's readings, becomes a necessary corrective, a cure for slippage. Here is the founding concept, and where have we gone from there? But can we condemn ourselves for that? No, like Freneau, we might write to Sir Toby and deal with the horrors of slavery in the West Indies. Or we might condemn the King of England for forcing slavery on us, as we did in the drafts of the Declaration of Independence, but then we removed those references, probably because we knew nobody would believe it. But the New Eden must be recovered. And that war, owing in part to Freneau, becomes glorious holy cause, as the Civil War will need the construction of our writers, our poets, so that it does not become that fratricidal war, that war between nations or between brothers, but it suddenly becomes the birth of a nation. It's the beginning, and there we are. We're constantly giving birth to ourselves. It's the way to stay young. And youth is at the center of our myth of identity. But just as Barlow's America is castigated for slavery, Freneau's America is scolded for its error. And the Native American, as Freneau depicts him in the Indian burying ground, is in that poem depicted as a wonderfully noble, admirable figure. And as soon as, you know, most of the enemy is killed, then poets begin to talk about them with nostalgia, admiration, and love, and they become the symbol of all that is positive, from raging, murdering savage to noble savage. The poems of the Revolution then displace error and failure onto England, to Europe. Such a move makes possible condemnation of the evils and wrongs which fall short of condemnation of the nation. We can position the error elsewhere. This is the work that the cultural products of a culture do. They come in, are called in, are produced in order to heal such threats, in order to mend such contradictions. In that same light, I could illustrate that in just a moment by noting how writers keep remaking one of our central cultural images. And here I'm focusing in the 19th century, late 19th century. We have a gift of a statue titled Liberty Enlightening the World, because Bartholdi, creator of that statue, wants the spirit of the American Revolution to spread out and to ignite other countries. The statue is titled Liberty Enlightening the World. Not when we got hold of it, because again, The revolution becomes unique event, but it does not offer precedent for consequent revolutions, as some people found out in the United States when they attempted it. It's almost, you know, as Robert Frost puts it, we do it first and then we cry, King's X, nobody else. But then we suddenly get a poem titled The New Colossus. And those words are inscribed on the base of the statue, at least the words of the poem that most people remember, because they don't read the typological part. The poem begins likening the statue to the Colossus at the harbor of Rhodes. But whereas there, in this ugly old over there, you have this huge warrior bestride the harbor and the ships pass between his huge legs, here is a lovely woman welcoming the homeless, the sick, the poor, etc. That wasn't Bartholdi's intention. I thought it was liberty enlightening the world. Not anymore. As a result of that poem, it becomes Mother of Exiles. There was no intention that it should be at all related to immigration. And if you look at our immigration laws, you know that we didn't think so either, because most of them are who can't come. And the immigration laws list all the people that the poem say are welcome. The wretched refuse of your teeming shores, send these the homeless tempest toss. You better read some of our immigration laws. But that's not the only time the poem is written about. Another poem, this one by John Greenleaf Whittier, the abolitionist poet par excellence. And suddenly, the statue is about liberty and enlighten the darkened minds of slaveholders. But then a New Hampshire man from Portsmouth, New Hampshire, who is quite conservative on a political scale from radical to reactionary, and he sees the fright of all these wretched people who are coming in because the gates are unbarred. There are no gates there. And he names all these awful people with their terrible babbles of language. All those people writing about the same cultural object within 30 years. There certainly is no agreement there. But there certainly seems to be consistency if we see only the excerpt from the New Colossus that is on the base of the statue, even though it is a distortion of the intention of the statue. But that would lead us to believe again in a monolith. A recovery would show us that Emma Lazarus was not the only definer of that object, not the only reconstructor or deconstructor of that object. Let me pull this close by jumping again closer to our own time in the 1980s. Ishmael Reed publishes a novel titled Flight to Canada, in which he conflates the 1830s, 40s with the 1980s, with Vietnam protest, and his novel situates itself in all those time spaces in order to argue absence of change. He calls it Flight to Canada. And looking in that work exercises again that south to north movement, which will solve, he finds in the 80s, nothing at all.